Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, that was What a Wonderful World by the great Sashmo. And it's Tuesday afternoon, and that means you got me, Jerry Pives, on Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. And today, we're really lucky to have Glenn Thurston with us. And Glenn has bravely decided to spend an hour in the Psychotherapist Chair. Welcome, Glenn.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for having me.
What makes you even consider putting yourself through sitting in my psychotherapist chair?
Well, why not? I mean, we can all learn something from this. It's all about being public and telling your story and being open about it so that these conversations become normalized in the future. It's not about me. It's about everyone. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's a big part of what this show is all about. Listen, tell the listeners what you get up to.
So I live down here in Wanaka in New Zealand, in South Island, and I am a builder by trade. But a year and a half ago, I ran a big mental health campaign in the construction industry. And I knew people were struggling, but I didn't realize just how much. So I sort of freed myself up from the company I was working with, and I just try to get around and help people as much as I can, contract myself around to try and help other tradies get through tight spots. I've done a bit of farming. I've worked in the snow. I went to Antarctica over Christmas. But yeah, ultimately, I always come back to the building at some point. It's just something that's there. But I struggled to sit in a job permanently for a long time, so I get itchy feet and I've got to move around. So yeah, contracting around and helping people out just works well for me. Just recently just came out of the bush after chasing a few possums to see if I could get a bit of cash that way and get a bit of mountain time. So just breaking it away from the general hustle and bustle of life. So if I can get those balances, it's really good. Yeah.
So well, you're a very humble guy because the listeners will get a lot out of listening to your interview with Cam Slater on a Reality Check Radio not so long ago, I think. And that interview was quite recent, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was only a couple of weeks ago, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the listeners should go and listen to that because that's a great interview. You guys really smashed it talking about your work with mental hunts and how you're really working to create this environment where, you know, hunting and mental health can be put together so people don't have to hide what they're going through for fear of losing their guns. I think it's a great project you're doing.
Yeah, there is a massive barrier at the moment, and this all stemmed from the Christchurch incident, and, you know, totally understand that. But the rush of let's put all these policies and not a lot of thought went into it. And now we're stuck with this legislation and, you know, health practitioners with, you know, fair to them, they're being very risk adverse because they don't want the responsibilities of it and put it all together. And now we've got farmers, firearms license holders, anyone that owns a firearms license is hearing all these horrible stories of situations like what happened to me and having my firearms revoked all because I went and sought help. Not actually looking at the big picture. So now we've got all these people not getting help. So I guess big part of mental hunts and what we're trying to do there is, yes, break down the barrier within the hunting community and create conversations, but not only that, educate them on the facts, because what happened to me and a lot of other people is it has changed. Still not perfect, but it is better. So trying to get those facts out to people, what their options are, what their legal requirements are, as well as big part of what I'm trying to do is educate people on how to look after each other. So I'm actually meeting with a lady tomorrow, but we're currently building a training platform so I can run seminars at NZDAs, gun clubs, school gun clubs, farming community, beef and lamb, whatever it has to be to try and educate people. They're not going to be hours and hours long, hour and a half, maybe 2 hours max. And it is just going to be a generic how to relate, how to respond, how to look after your friends, what to do if someone comes to you and tells you that they're suicidal, or if you knowing how to ask that question, things like that, things that I just think is what's going to change what mental health looks like in this country. We're doing a lot in this country to raise money for counselling services and free support, but we don't have the counsellors, we don't have the psychologists. We're doing is creating a bigger wait list than actually fixing the problem. I think we need to take a step further back and educate everyone with and arm everyone with the tools to support not only themselves but their friends, their families. And hopefully that can slow. It's not going to happen overnight. It'll take years to show any difference. But, I mean, you've only got to look at the health and safety in the building industry, you know. I think the stats are now there's like 10 people a year die from workplace accidents, which is not very many. We all jumped up and down when health and safety started saying you need to don't stand on that ladder. Got to have scaffolding, you got to have this, you need your first aid, you need that. We all screamed and said, oh, this is a waste of money, but it works. So by educating people with the right tools, looking after people and showing them how to help others in need of, you know, first aid, same way with mental health, if we can do the same there, it's got to slow it down. It's not going to make it zero. We're not going to stop suicides, when, you know, but if we can slow it down, stop a lot of people going to seek help when they probably just need a friend. Not everybody. There are a lot of people that genuinely get a lot of benefit from getting support, and I'm all for it. But there's a massive amount of people that probably don't need to line up and go and clog up the system unnecessarily. If they just had a close friend that knew how to talk to them, I think that's where we need to focus government money, our own personal time as human beings. It's our moral responsibility to look after each other, I feel.
You know, one of the reasons I do this show, Glenn, is because, you know, in the week I can only see a few clients, tiny handful, you know. But on the radio here, in this show, there's three sections. You know, if you're listening in, you're hearing the first one, which is Glenn sitting in the chair, the hot chair, if you like. Then I do some reflections, and I always aim to share a useful tool or model for understanding who we are and how we live. And then the third section actually is in itself, because I'm going to invite you back, Glenn, and you're going to tell me about the music that's been important through your life for different periods. And I can't overemphasize the power and the role that music can play in just discharging and releasing pent-up energy, you know, like all sorts of activities. But so this program is all about normalizing and giving people tools and helping people. And actually, what I give is often the tiniest bit, because very often these interviews, these sessions in the chair, help people realize, oh, I could do that. I could get out and exercise, or I could shift a bit and go and see someone, or I could learn a bit more, or whatever. So these shows are really, you know, about what you're talking about, which is let's have everyone supported in dealing with stuff, rather than leaving it to a few specialists or experts who are, like you say, clogged up a wait list. We're building up a wait list. I'm completely with you, man, on this. Wonderful work. Fantastic.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And I mean, you're going to throw a few tools out, which I think is amazing. And I talk about doing education and stuff. I myself have done so many mental health training seminars of my own, but each one I've taken something different. They all run a little bit differently. And so, you know, just because you've been like first aid, they're all the same, same. Whereas all these mental health ones, there's no one rule. No one person has the right answer. But each one, I take one little tool with me. Sometimes I take nothing away, and then all of a sudden something clicks, or I meet someone there and I meet with that person and they give me a tool. There's so many other ways around it. It's a conglomerate of everything come together. It's not just one person. I don't have the answers for anyone. As you can imagine, in my position now, I have a lot of people reach out to me, and the first thing I say to them, I don't have your answers. You know, I'm still on my own journey, and I'll probably be on it for a long time, probably to the end of time. It's something I've realized I need to work at every day, just like going to the gym. You know, if you stop going to the gym, you stop building muscle. If you stop working on your mental health, your mental health deteriorates, just like your physical health. So yeah, it's something I work on, and I tell people I don't have the answers. But if there's something that I've done that you think you could have a crack at and it works for you, awesome. I'm real happy. But, you know, I can tell you what's worked for me, and, you know, and I'm here to listen. That's about it. But them opening up to me is the first step of them showing that they don't want to be the person that they are, or they don't want the feelings or the thoughts that they're having. So I just embrace the fact that people are reaching out, because previously people aren't talking, you know. We have come a long way from where mental health was, but we still do have a long way to go. You know, there's still a very stoic crowd of people, and I think farming, hunting community is definitely, and building industry is very stoic. But it is getting better, and a lot of people are talking. And I don't know, maybe it's because of what I'm doing. It opens up the conversations more, so I hear it more. But I do hear stories around of other people having some people come to them. So, you know, it's very promising to hear. Yeah.
Well, if the listeners want to find you, I believe they can go to mentalhunts.co.nz. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. The website's there, and that's pretty much got a link to everything. They can contact us. It's got our YouTube channel. So ultimately, Mental Hunts sort of started with the idea of a YouTube channel of creating hunting shows with a bit of a difference, with a mental health element to it. And we've only just started, and we had the Firearm Safety Authority on the first episode, and that was purely just to get the answers, the facts out to the people. Next episode we're about to film is real life people's stories, a bit like what you do here, and them talking about their journeys with a positive aspect of, okay, they sought help, and they didn't lose their firearms. Because we're hearing all these horror stories of people losing firearms. So everyone's like, oh, shit, I can't go to the doctor. It's about finding the right people to talk to and continuing to seek help. That's the most important thing. Any mental distress, as you know, unchecked is not a healthy situation. It might get by for a year or two, but give it 5 years, 10 years of manifesting it, and it's going to get real ugly and be a major problem to fix. So you know, if you're having a little bit of a hard time now, deal with it. Speak to someone, friend, go see your doctor, forget about your firearms, and just go seek help. The chances are you won't. There are steps you can take too with your firearms, as far as handing them over to your friend and getting them to look after before you go to the GP. Just shows, you know, when it does go down to the Firearm Safety Authority, you'll be seen as being fit and proper, you're doing all the right things. You know, that's what it's about, and that's our responsibility as a firearms license holder. That's what we need to do to keep the community safe. So it's not a bad thing. It's just being responsible about it and knowing what you can and can't do.
Well, I want to send the listeners to your interview with Cam. It's a great interview, and you tell your story there, and you tell your story about the guns and what happened to you. You got your gun license back though, didn't you?
Yeah, I have my firearms license back now. I've had it for quite some time now. And it was pretty much, I was dead set on getting it back from day one. And then I knew as soon as I got it back, I was going to start cracking the whip and finding out what the hell's going on with this situation, because it wasn't right. But I was very careful before that, because I thought if I start rattling cages, I'll probably never get my guns back again, because I'll be red flagged. So, yeah, I've got my firearms license back in. And I guess a big myth, and I do talk about it on Cairns, is medication. I am on medication, and I'll probably be on medication for the rest of my life. I take a very small amount of fluoxetine, one tablet a day, 20 milligrams, and it just takes that edge away from me. A lot of people contact me and say, oh, I had medication this year and I got to renew my license and I'm scared I'm not going to get my license back. You won't, it's not going to affect, as long as you disclose that information. I am on medication and I got my license back after having it revoked. So it's a 100% myth, and it is case by case scenario of people's situations, because my mental health, the guy next door to him, is all different. Everyone's situation is different. There's no one mental health issue. This is why I hate the word mental health, or when you're filling out forms, have you had mental health issues? Like, my answer to that is, what is your real question? what are you wanting to know? Because there's a lot of branches to that question. You know, are you worrying me? Have I got an anxiety, or do I have an eating disorder? Do I, you know, am I schizophrenic? Am I psychopathic? Am I, you know, what are you asking me? Do I get sad? Am I drunk? And, you know, there's so many sides to that. That one word. It's not like, I really struggle with the word mental health, which is why we've played on the word with mental hunts. I'm trying to make it a positive thing and play on it more so than have it a scary word to talk about. Mental, it just comes back from back in the day with mental institutions and getting locked away, and it's just carried on. And so there's not a person that you and I probably bump into in the streets that doesn't have a mental health issue. So it's like, why ask the question when the answer is yes for everybody?
Ain't that the truth? And you know what? I've been in the profession since the age of 21. Even when I started, my life started with as training as a teacher. Mm-hmm. After I got my degree in history, I moved to teaching. And in my year, in my first piece of sort of studying as a teacher, when I was training as a teacher, I chose to do a study on adolescent suicide. So, right, I didn't even realize I was going to be interested in psychotherapy or psychology, but I look back and I go, man, I was fascinated by what causes things to go wrong. So I've been in it since the age of 21. So that's 46 years. I'm 67 now, and I still don't know what that word, I don't know what mental health is. I don't know what people are talking about. It's like every person I work with is an amazing, remarkable survivor. Do you know what? They're still alive. Ergo, they're a brilliant survivor. That's where I start from.
Yeah. I look at myself now and I think my mental health, my depression and everything has actually made me the strongest person I am now. Now that I've come through it out the other side, I mean, people struggling with depression or any mental illness like that is they're living 2 to 3 lives like around different people trying to put on this facade that everything's good. It is so draining, and they're running businesses. And, you know, you try and live 3 lives. If you can release one or two of those and just relax and come back to who you are, it's so empowering as to what you can actually do as a human. And this is why I'm putting all my energy into trying to let people know that I don't have any degrees. I left school at 15. I got an apprenticeship building. I'm no academic. I've got not one degree under my belt. I've done a lot of adult learning as I've gotten older, but here I am knocking on the door with politicians and working with government organizations, all because I've got a passion about something that when I was in that darkest place, I didn't think there was anything. And I've been very fortunate not to have stepped over the line. Well, I did step over the line, but I've managed to bounce out of those bad decisions and can see the other side of it. And that doesn't mean my life is randy and I'm full of happy days every single day of my life. I still have shit days. Like I just said to you, I've been bushed for 4 days because life just sort of got a bit on top of me in the last few weeks, just work and everything. So it's like, what do? I go bush. I just go and get some me time, think, and hang out with myself. Everyone's quick to run to people and go party and try and socialize. I'm the opposite. I need to get some solitude and get some clarity in my life. I just went out possuming and then lit the fire and just sat there and thought and tried to figure out what my next steps were. And that's what works for me. Sometimes it's going hunting. Sometimes it's just climbing mountains. And I love not alpine climbing, but, you know, mountain running. I love getting out in the hills and just working up a hell of a sweat to climb mountains. It's what I do. So, yeah.
How much of your story would you be happy to share right here on the radio about what was going on? How did you discover that actually you needed to crack this one? You needed to really sort things out for yourself. Would you be willing to share that with me and the listeners, Glenn?
Yeah, 100%. I will. Yeah, no worries at all. I quite regularly go on, do talks these days and tell my story. So I guess for me, it actually started a long time ago, back when I was 18. I say a long time ago, but when I was 18, I just living everyday life like any 18-year-old.
How old are you now, Glenn? Let the listeners know.
I'm 45 now. And I was living in Aussie. I was born and bred in Australia originally, and I was living in Adelaide at the time when I was 18. And I was drinking pretty heavily as a young fella, just, you know, partying and hanging out with mates. And it was just what we did on the building site, and, you know, knock off work, grab a few beers for the drive home. Anyway, I ended up this one night really, really drunk, and still to this day don't know what caused me to get to this feeling, but ended up waking in hospital after an attempt on taking my life, which was a big eye-opener for me, because I didn't even know I had those feelings in me. I didn't even know I was feeling sad. I didn't even know, well, I'd say sad, but depressed or whatever it was that led me to that moment. Yes, I was drunk, which is a big part of it. And anyway, after that, I went and got some help, and I was seeing, I can't remember what it was called, In the Blues. It was some government counselling service, but it really didn't work for me. It was back in those days, it was still relatively new with all this sort of thing, and no one really knew what to do. And it was a little bit experimental, I suppose. They tried to get me on medication and I refused. I said, no, I'm not going on medication, because apparently dropping out of school at 15, I know more than the medical profession about medication. So I just self-medicated with alcohol. And that's pretty much in a nutshell what I did. I just ended up getting away from that counselling and just got on with my life and thought, nah, there's nothing wrong with me. That was just a hiccup in the road. Never really faced it properly, never really dealt with it. Had a few moments, had some really good times. In that time between then and now, I'd obviously met my wife when I was about 20, I think it was about 20, yeah, and she was 17. So we've been together for a long time. We ended up getting married. We've now got three beautiful daughters. We moved over here when my eldest was only 6 months old, so she's now 19. So we've been here in Wanaka now 20 years. And I sort of thought moving over here was going to be great, get away from all the past and the history of my life, because it was always in the back of my mind. And then I got over here and, you know, got into building and then had a dream to start a gym and I had a business and I got complete burnout and I started burning out big time and financially was stressing and things weren't going that great financially. And I just felt like I was failing as a father. I couldn't provide for my family and everything just manifested. And at this point I was drinking heavily. And I've always drunk pretty heavily. And then I'd also binge drink pretty hard out. And eventually got to a night when I was 38, just having a massive night on a October Labor long weekend, and three bottles of wine in, it was just nearly the end of me. I was on the way out, to be fair, and I'd given up. I was just very lucky this night my wife came out, which she never did when I was sitting around drinking. She'd just go to bed. And yeah, I don't think if she didn't come out that night, I don't think I'd be here to this day. So I woke up the next morning, said to her, I'm done. I'm getting off the booze. I can't do this anymore. And she said, yeah, heard it all before. And from that point, I thought, right, this has got to change. I'm going to prove her wrong. I'm going to prove myself wrong. And I'm going to fix this, because I got to do it. Otherwise, I'm not going to be here for my girls, who were growing up real fast. And their dad was just being a drunk. Not a bad drunk. Was never an angry drunk. I just drank socially. I was just hiding behind my emotions, I suppose. And with that, I checked into the GP and she referred me to brief intervention. And finally, I succumbed to taking some medication and it was the best thing I ever did in my life. It doesn't change me in a personality way. I just don't have those demon thoughts anymore. I just was always living life in a hurry, like it was going to end next week. You know, I look back now for the last, you know, 20 years, I've just been rushing everything and making rash decisions and moving jobs and making new decisions, life changes, just thinking, well, who cares? It's not going to matter next week, sort of thing. But yeah, finally I get direction. I see a future. I see where I'm going with things, and it's a great feeling. And I get I get a lot of joy in sharing these stories with people, because the amount of people come to me and go, shit, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think you've also hit the nail on the head in just grabbing everyday people for your show, because we hear a lot of stuff on TV with all these TV icons and, you know, Mike Kings and Matt Chisholms and John Kerwins and all that. And, you know, they're great stories and they're true stories, but they're also All Blacks that walk into a stadium with 10,000 people. We can't relate to that, but we can relate to the guy next door having the exact same feelings, you know? So I think everyday people sharing their vulnerabilities with each other makes people realize they're not alone, and you know, you can get through it. You very cliche, but you can. And like I say, my life's not perfect. We have ups and downs and financial battles, and still to this very day. But there's a lot more clarity in it, and I know that I'm heading in the right direction, and quitting is not an option. And I think the biggest part for me was alcohol abuse. That's what would have killed me. That would have been the end of it. So getting on top of that was a big part of my healing. And by no means do I think the whole world needs to give up alcohol and alcohol shouldn't be sold, it should be banned. No, I don't, you know, if you can drink it in moderation, and good for you, I'm happy for you and go for it. But I myself couldn't have one beer. I was one beer and I was one box in, or one bottle of wine led to three bottles of wine. And I was always getting anxious when I could see a bottle getting empty. And, you know, that's if you can relate to that feeling, yeah, you probably need to have a look at how you're drinking. But, you know, if you can slow it down, cool. If you can't, get off it. I highly recommend it. Life's great. Through that process, I did get a lot of, when I finally got help and I finally got off the booze, I mean, there was a good year there. I just got very social anxiety. I just couldn't be around groups of people. I could see through the bullshit coming out of people's mouths. It was just like, I don't even want to listen to this. I just don't want to be around here. Even struggled to go down and watch the kids do their triathlons of the Challenge Wanaka and things, because there was just so many people around. I had to walk down the end of the lake just to get away from everyone and watch from afar. I struggled for about a year just to, coming from a very social life of boozing and partying and having a good time and being the life of the party with everybody, to not being able to want to be around anyone. And hence why I was very fortunate to get a job on a farm, which was great. But then I started getting to the point after about 2-3 years, I was starting to get the need to want to be around people again. You know, I was comfortable with not drinking and so forth. So, yeah, it comes around in cycles all the time. And you know, 1 year is not like the last. So, you know, it's always expecting the unexpected and knowing how to handle it and what direction to go, because sometimes my tools that I got in the bag don't work and I've got to dig some new ones out or go and ask some more questions. I'm now nearly 8 years sober, and I'll be completely and utterly honest with you. I haven't craved alcohol other than the first sort of 2 years until about a week and a half ago, and I was struggling. I was really having a bit of a downturn. This is very recent, hence why I had to go away for a while. I just had to take myself away from any temptations and any stresses and anything that was going on, because you know, I do have a lot going on with this mental hunt, but I love it. And then there's days I sit there and go, well, who the hell am I to be doing this? Who the hell am I to be teaching people? But then I get a message from someone who's having a really, really bad time, and it's like, well, that's why I'm doing this. But there's a lot of politics and there's a lot of money needed and financial support I need, and I don't have the academic brain to get it. And it's like, shit, am I wasting my time? And, yeah, I've really battled about a week ago not to get back on the booze, and I reached out to someone for help, and yeah, I got a reply, but I was hoping to have a chat to them, but they never actually reached out. So I guess if someone ever reaches out to you, give them a call, because it was hard, eh? And I've managed to push my way through it, and you know, I've come back out of the bush, and I'm already like, I'm glad I got through that, because it was a very short period of time, whereas before I would have probably just given up and gone and got pissed. But, you know, I didn't expect I was going to go through life and never want a beer ever again. But for a long period of time, I haven't craved any alcohol and then to all of a sudden have this urge. And I think it comes back to a bit of financial stress has been going on, and you start going down that road. But yeah, I've dug out all my tools, and I sort of know where I'm going, and I know what I need to do, and I know where I need to prioritize my time, and that's ultimately family, and that's what I'll do, and put my time into my family, and the work and the money will come. But I'm not out to get rich. I get rich in helping people. I get rich in the responses I get from people when I do my talks. If I get one person come to me and tell me that they got so much out of the talk, it's just been worth every cent of taking time off work to do it. But like this, you know, sitting here for the next few hours with you on a Tuesday, I'd rather do that than go to work sometimes. And I don't get paid a cent for it. And it's very rewarding though. But eventually I've got to get back to work, and that's where I got to find that balance. I'll get there.
Well, if you're wondering who you're listening to and what you're listening to, I'm assuming you know you're on Reality Check Radio and you're listening to me, Jerry Pives, on Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. And sitting in the chair is Glenn Thurston of mentalhunts.co.nz. And Glenn, I just really want to stroke and appreciate your honesty. The fact that you're willing to sit here and say, after 8 years of being sober, you just really wanted a drink not so very long ago. And man, it broke my heart to hear that you reached out and no one came back to you. So listen, at the end of this show, I'm going to give you my phone number, because if you want to reach out and you want someone to talk to, I'm nearby. I'm in Wanaka too, man. We can meet up and have a coffee and a chat or a walk by the lake. Love to do that with you, fella. You're doing really important work. And I suspect that some of the pressure you're under is challenging all the tools that you've learned from before, right? So you learned tools over years of work. And I just want you to know that I would take one of you over 10 qualified, degree-ridden, certificated psychotherapists any day. I would take one of you instead of 10 of them, because what you're talking about is your real life experience, and people relate to that. They don't want to hear famous, successful people talking about how they went into a $40,000 rehab program. That's really not very relevant to most of us, right?
I can't even afford to go to the doctor, the GP half the time, let alone any rehab thing. So yeah. The only thing that got me through this was my own grit and determination. I mean, I would have loved to have gone and got the treatment I needed, but not most people can't afford that, hence why they just fall back on the easy road of self-eliminating their brain cells so they don't have to think about it. And that's why we do it.
Or feel the pain and the discomfort. I think it's really important what you're talking about. And I know from my own experience that every time I've stepped up a little bit, you know, made myself a bit more out there, a bit more visible. For me, it's about being visible. Man, something hits in and I want to do destructive things, you know? So it's like I go up. Every time I start to feel negative or destructive or like I'm going down those rabbit holes that we can all have, well, I think everyone's got them, if I'm really honest. I used to say, scratch any human being and you'll find, if you talk to them long enough, you'll find pain, you'll find history that, you know, stuff happened that really affects people. Well, every time that happens, I start to say to myself, Jerry, you must have stepped up somewhere and not realized it, because these demons, they come at you when every time I make myself more visible, every time I'm doing more for more people, the demons have a go at me. And so now I just say, hey, bring it on, demons. I love it. I love it. You're here. You're attacking me. Must be doing something good.
Yeah, I can relate to that. As soon as I feel any form of success, I self-sabotage. I don't know what it is, but I've always been like it. And even when I know deep down that I'm doing all the right things, I still think I'm not good enough, or I could do better, or someone's better than me, or yeah. So I can totally relate to that feeling. It's definitely the more I do well, the more I dislike myself for some weird reason. It's and I don't know why that is, but yeah.
Well, I'm going to talk about how we develop life scripts very, very early on. And every time we step outside of the way we survived, we're going to hit the script. And I sometimes call it demons, but I also call it the script. I hit the script. And we have to rewrite these scripts because when we wrote them, we were only 3 years old. So we didn't have a lot of resources available to us. But coming back to you, Glenn, to you and your journey, first of all, thank you for sharing that. I'd love to know, and I'm sure the listeners would love to know, I mean, there's a lot of people out there who do reach for the drink. I mean, look, it's a lot harder to work out this shit than just go to the off license. Where I'm sitting, I can see two things. I can see my off license, and right next to it, I can see the church. So they're literally right next door to each other. You probably know it in Monaco, but there's the off license on Rees Avenue, and next to it there's the New Life Church. All right, and I go to that church, and I thought, you know what? Why don't we put a little notice at the off license with one of those hands pointing, like thumb up, and pointing like a gun, actually pointing, say, hey, struggling with life, try something different.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh no. Oh no, it's crazy, eh?
I'd love to know what helped you, particularly around the drink, Glenn. Was it just a decision, or did you reach out? How did you do it?
It was 100% a decision, and there was no magic trick for me. And everyone laughs when I tell them what it was, but those people that know me, I'm reasonably competitive sort of person when it comes to any sort of competition. I don't do a lot of it these days, but I do a lot of competing against myself, my own mind, my own times, my own this. I don't do compete against others as much as I used to. But when I gave up drinking, like AA was never an option for me. It wasn't my thing. I'm not one to sit around in groups and circles and talk like that. So I knew I just had to bite the bullet and do it. So I ended up downloading an app, which was basically a counter of how many days you've been sober. And it's called, I think it's actually called Sober, the app, but it counts your days. But when you get on it, you put in the date and you put in how much you spend. Well, I put in $20 a day, which is very, very generous. And I'll open it up now. But then anytime I was having a hard day, I'd look at that and all of a sudden it'd say, oh, you've been sober for 34 days or 60 days, 2 months, and you get awarded all these little things. Nothing that exciting. But it also tells you how much money you've saved based on how much you put in. And today, apparently, I've saved $56,880 over the period of 8 years. I don't have a cent of that, but it's rewarding. But the biggest thing for me is I look at that now and I say 7 years, 9 months, and 14 days of freedom. If I go and have one beer, that goes to zero. So I've just lost. I got to start. Whether anyone knows or not, I know I'm back to zero, and I don't want to go back to zero. My goal is to see how high I can get that number. So that's what I do. I use that as a competition against myself, and it works for me. Like I say, it doesn't mean I'm invincible, but it works for me. And going to AA for some people is what they need. They need to be around people. I didn't find the urge. My father went to AA, and there was a time when I was drunk and had a fight with my brother, and my mum made me go to it and with dad. And it was just, I was never going to go back to that. It was not my cup of tea. But for those that it works for, I think it's great. One thing doesn't work for one, but it works for another. So, yeah, cool. Go for it. I've also been down and attended the peer support group a couple of times, or quite a few times for a good year or so. I found that quite good, a little bit different to AA. But it was just more I guess this is where it all stemmed from for me to get out a bit more public, because I'd go to this peer support group and we'd go in the room, we'd talk about how shit we're feeling, and we're all in the same boat, and it was great. You'd have these great conversations with people, and you could be open about your feelings, you could be open about what's happening. And then you'd go outside those doors and you'd have to hide again. It's like, why do we have to go into silence every time we come out of this room? Why can't we just be like this in everyday life? So hence why I started the campaign of Turn the Corner with the construction industry and got that cranking and got conversation going. And then I started getting more open about my, it's sort of just evolved for me to be this mental health advocate. And I love every minute of it. But I find the more open I am about it, the more people it's helping, and it's very rewarding. The five ways of well-being, I think, you know, one of them is give. I think I've taken that to the next level. You know, get in nature, give. I can't remember the others. There's something to be said about giving back to others.
Well, that's really interesting, Glenn, that you say that. And by the way, that's a great little app you mentioned. Wonderful. And I love the fact that you say, you know, what works for one doesn't necessarily work for all, you know, that we're all different. And when someone walks through into my treatment room, it's like I try and let them know that walking through that door can be harder than running 53 mountaintops in 53 days.
Yeah, that was easy. Getting out of bed for all those years before that was a damn sight harder than climbing that mountain for 53 days in a row. The analogy would say, it's, you know, getting out of bed each day with depression is like climbing a mountain. Hence why I climbed a mountain for 53 days.
If you're listening and you're wondering why we're talking about climbing mountains for 53 days, Glenn, just explain what you did.
Yeah. So over Christmas 21, 22, where are we now? Yeah. I climbed a mountain in Lake Awea, Corner Peak, 53 times in 53 days in honor of the average suicide in the construction industry, just trying to raise awareness to the amount of suicides there was and the amount of depression. I mean, that's six times more than people dying from workplace accidents, and yet there's been stuff all getting done about it. Mates in Construction is a training model they use in the construction industry, and I got on board with them to try and encourage tradies to get them down south, because they're up in Auckland and it was no good to us down here, and no one around here knew about them or the training programs they did. So fortunately now we've got them in the South Island and there's field offices here, so that got them down here. In climbing Corner Peak 53 times, I invited tradies to come join me with their companies. So in that time of climbing Corner Peak, I had about 330 people come and join me out of the local community. They travelled as far as Auckland down to climb the hill with me just to show their support. And for me, it was a real eye-opener. I was hoping to get a few people get involved, but yeah, to get that many was, it just showed me how many people. And not one person on that hill didn't have a story of some kind, regardless of what angle it came from, whether it was them or someone else, or, you know, family members they'd lost or whatever. So it was very, very humbling. I was fortunate enough to have a videographer follow me most of the time. He pretty much climbed it 27 times himself out of the 53 and videoed as much as he could. He had 13 hours of video footage to put together a 10-minute short film, which has won quite a few awards through New Zealand and the Mountain Film Festival. And so if anyone wants to see that, it's on our Mental Hunts YouTube channel. It's a very, very well put together film by Ned Brannigan. He did a really good job of telling the story to navigate through 13 hours of footage to put that story together. And he's a man that hasn't had any personal depressive issues of his own and was just completely overwhelmed by the conversations he was hearing and how big a problem it really is. So yeah, that's Corner Peak in a nutshell. And Turn the Corner is what we dubbed it, because we all need to turn a corner in the way we treat mental health. That's the reason behind that.
Tell the listeners a bit about the peer support group. You mentioned that as well. Tell us a bit more about that. What is it?
Wanaka has a peer support group. I haven't been for years, but there was one time when I was driving in from the farm and I was picking up my daughter from work or dropping her off, and I heard it on the radio that it was on that night. So I thought, oh, I'll call in. And it was just we sat down, they'd do a 5-minute meditation at the start, and then there was no one forced to talk or anyone was asked to talk. If anyone wanted to talk, they could. And it was just pretty much sit around and have a yarn. And if you wanted to offload your day, you would. There was no structure to it or anything. And it just flowed, a bit like this conversation. It just kept going, and then we'd go on to another. And if someone was really having a hard time, we'd just listen and see if there's anything we could do to support them or guide them or get them the extra help they needed, and more a case of reaching out later on in the weeks, not just leaving it to every fortnight when we catch up. So for me, that was good, because most of my life, you know, I've battled this depression, and my wife knew. She's known the whole time, and she's watched me drink myself stupid and kept hung by me for 20 years. So to be able to go somewhere and offload and give her a break was really important to me, because, and hence the reason why I've got myself better, is I owe it to her. I owe it to my family. She stood by me for 20 years. The least I can do is get off the piss and sort my shit to show her how much I love her and appreciate the support she's given me. So it's a case of trying to separate myself and find other ways to offload it with other people. I do that really well these days, because I talk to everybody and anybody, and it's the best feeling. I don't have to look over my shoulder anymore. I don't have to disguise anything. I don't have to be anyone I'm not. I don't give two shits what anyone thinks about me anymore. There's no secrets. If anyone thinks they can find shit on me and they want to use it against me, good luck to them. Not that I really ever had any, but you live life like that. You feel like you're living this secret life for no reason. You know, I've always had suicidal thoughts my whole life, and just thought it was normal. And, you know, like I say, I went into the doctor the second time, and when I tried to get off the medication, and he says to me, "You're having suicidal thoughts?" Yeah. And then he started talking about taking my guns off me. But the thing was, he didn't ask me the question, "Do you want to die?" Because the answer to that is no. Like, people have suicidal thoughts doesn't mean they want to die. And if they're going to go to the doctor and tell them they're having suicidal thoughts, it's because they don't want to die. They don't want the feeling. They don't want the thoughts. They don't want to feel like that. It's so, so draining having those thoughts and fighting those thoughts without knowing what to do. And it gets darker and darker and darker. And in the end, you know, you have one stupid night on the piss and you make the wrong decision. So anyone that's going to go to the doctor, like you say, and you say they're a winner, I totally agree, you know. And when it comes to this firearm stuff that I talk about, does that not make you fit and proper? As far as I'm concerned, anyone that's going to go to the doctor to get help, that makes them a fit and proper firearms license holder, because they're trying to support their health. So why punish all these people and take their guns? Because all they're doing now is stopping people from wanting to go get help. I think they should be rewarded and then guided and say, look, how about you just drop your guns at your mate's house just for now, just to do the right thing, or anything. You know, it doesn't need to go straight down that fear factor because of one idiot's stupidity in a city. We all know what happened in Christchurch, and don't want to glorify that by any means, but you know, that's just, you're never going to get rid of those idiots. They're always going to be around. It doesn't mean the whole world should be punished for that stupidity. The majority of people actually do want to get better. They do want to feel good. Those people are never going to want to get better. They don't, you know, they don't have the capacity to do so.
Jung said something, I think it went something like, the fact that you know that you're hearing voices means that you're already sane. You're aware of the destructive parts of being human makes you human, makes you sane. And I would add, and can talk about it and not beat yourself up for it and accept that there are voices within us, there are parts within us, many, many parts. You know, my approach is transactional analysis. And in 1957, Eric Byrne, the founder of that, he said, look, we've all got, and he'd been doing psychiatry and Freudian stuff all his life. And he was, you know, he'd been very experienced. And he said, look, basically, we've got a child part that carries a whole bunch of stuff. We've got an adult part that tries to engage with everyday reality and success. And we've got a parent part, which is all the messages we got from people. And actually, when he really talked about it, he said, you know what, within each of those three kind of, we've got multiple parts of ourselves within each of those. And the aim of health is to be able to make peace with all those parts, you know, not to exclude them or try and pretend they're not there, but we just got to get in there and do a bit of group therapy with ourselves.
Yeah, 100%. My biggest thing is I'd see someone grumpy or angry all the time. I'd just say, oh, what a grumpy old prick. But these days I look at them and go, what's actually going on in their life? It's amazing when you've been through it and you actually look at people differently in every way. And even just with a little bit, the more training I've had about it, I even look deeper. So the training, there's a lot to be said for education around mental health. And, you know, I know the whole world's not going to all of a sudden become empathetic and be living this peaceful world, but, you know, there's a lot of people that would pick it up. I think the other thing, you know, we talked before, we've got a shortage of psychologists and psychiatrists and counsellors. People go and do their first aid certificates for work. They might find themselves at an incident. They save someone's life. They love it. They realise they want to do that for the rest of their life. Same thing's going to happen here. If people get educated in mental health training, and then they have someone reach out to them, or they see signs in someone and they need help, and they have a successful, you know, catch up with that person, and they feel very good about themselves helping that person. Next minute, they're going to sign up on a, you know, I might become a counsellor. I really got rewards out of this. I enjoyed this. I want to do this for a living. We'll probably find there'd be more people wanting to get into the career path of supporting people because they see the rewards of it. They see the benefits of. I mean, a lot of people say to me, why don't you do it? I said, I don't want to do it. It's not my thing. I like helping people just by being who I am. But there's a lot of people out there that are really good at helping people that just never even thought about it. And when they get put in that position and actually help someone and realize how rewarding it is, I think you would have two things. The wait list would go down because people are getting the help, and the supply of counselors would be more.
The sums are pretty simple. Really?
You can raise all the money you like for this cliff edge support, but wouldn't be better off put all that money, this 24 million, whatever, going into counselling services. How about we put it into educating and training programs that we can distribute around the country? Apprenticeships. When we're doing an apprenticeship, do a mental health module. Every single apprenticeship, whether it's hospitality, whether it's finance, whether it's building, let's put that module in your thing, just like we do first aid. We even the fire service, for crying out loud. I mean, I was in the fire brigade for 7 years in Wanaka. Nothing on mental health. And yet I still remember to this day getting called out to a call. Don't have lights and sirens on because the person's suicidal and they're threatening to la-di-da-di-da. And it's like, well, we're not trained for this shit. And then you see what you see, and then you've got to be able to deal with that. No mental health training, and yet now, to become a recruit firefighter, you've got to go and do a 2-day first aid course in order to do it. Okay, cool. How about we throw a day in for mental health training? Because that's a massive part of it. If you rock up to a car accident and someone's died, family there, you've got to know how to support them, know whether to check in, and chances are you're going to know that person, small communities and fire service. So, you know, I'm really pushing the fire service to do more mental health training.
And on that front, Glenn, what kind of educational or interesting sort of courses and stuff have you found useful for you?
So Blueprint for Learning, Mental Health 101, well, I found was really good. It's not very medical. It's just simplified. It's real. You do talk about suicide. It's not a dangerous word to talk about. You can talk about suicide without making someone want to suicide, much to people's horror. Like I go on the radio and you're not even allowed to talk about suicide in case it's going to trigger someone. Well, I've had suicidal thoughts my whole life, and talking about suicide or people talking to me about suicide hasn't made me want to go on suicide. But definitely Blueprint for Learning. The other one is Good Yarn. They do they run them all around the country in different places. That was originally set out for rural as well. Good Yarn training, a little bit shorter. But just as beneficial, and like I say, I got a lot out of that. Intentional peer support, that was a really good one. That was a 2-day intensive, more of an assist training one. Now, for anyone that's in construction, definitely Mates in Construction, get hold of them and find out when they're going to be in any. They're all through the country. They do 3 tiers of training. They've got general awareness training, connectors training, and assist training. Obviously, three different levels. The first one's 45 minutes. It's just an introduction into what the issue is and what we can do. And then the connectors are a day, and then the assist is a two-day one. So quite intensive, so that you can actually support people. Connector is more about guiding people and listening and helping them get to the right places. So, but none of this are we, none of any of these training education things or what I want to do is telling people to fix people. You're not there to fix people. You're not there to find the answers or tell them what they need to do. It's just about learning how to relate to them, how to respond to them, what questions to ask them, and know how to get them to the right place and where to take them. By no means, if someone falls off a scaffolding, all you're there to do is to throw a blanket over them and stop the bleeding until the professionals get there to save their life. You know, as a first aider, you're not there to do surgery. You're not expected to. And it's the same for mental health. No one's expecting you to save someone's life, but just by listening to them, believe me, you are. And reaching out to someone, you are saving their life. Simple thing I do very regularly, and it is flick a message out to someone. I obviously have a lot of people that I know have had hard times. I'll just randomly just think, I haven't spoken to that person, flick them a message. Hey, I haven't chatted to you for a while. Last time we spoke, you were having a hard time. How's things? I hope things are looking better for you. Shit, it just sparks a great conversation, a huge appreciation. And I do this because when I did my intentional peer support, there was a lady there, and she just did that to me about, 3 months after we got off the course, just sent me this message. And it was the nicest feeling, and it made me feel so good inside. And I was feeling shit at the time. It was almost like she sensed it. And it just, you just never know what someone's going through when you flick them that message. If they don't reply, cool, that's their choice. But don't give up. Flick them another one another couple of months. And you just never know when that person needs it. And this lady just randomly would send these messages, and holy crap, it made me feel good. So I thought, I want to do that to others. And I do. And I love reaching out to people, and I genuinely want to hear how they're getting on, and that life's great. Sometimes it's really shit, and I'll soon be down having a coffee with them or driving across the country to catch up with someone. But generally it's just a quick chat on the messenger. We all sit there at night this day and age, scrolling on our phones, flick a message. And do something productive, you know, help someone.
And if there's any listener listening who's, and you really are at this moment, you know, grappling with suicidal thoughts, and it feels quite urgent, there's something called the New Zealand Mental Health Foundation, which you can reach out to, and that's got a 24/7 kind of support. But, you know, just talk to a buddy, talk to a mate, ring them up. You can do it yourself. You don't have to wait for someone to flick you a message, right? You can ring up and say, hey, how about we have a coffee, or can we just talk for a bit because I'm feeling a bit rough? Talking to a buddy, you know, a coffee catch-up, for example, just once a week with a mate, but not for work, not for money, not because you're in a terrible, terrible place, but just talking to someone you enjoy being with and you enjoy chewing the cud. I love what you do, you know, going out on the hunts, being active. But for fellas, you know, I know in my work, we sit in a room. I actually do a fair amount of body work, so we're quite active. But for fellas, sometimes sitting down is not the best thing. It's like a lot of the stuff that we need to deal with happened when we were quite young. And, you know, boys more than girls, they cannot sit still. I don't know what our education system is on. It's on drugs, right? The educators are on drugs, surely. Because if you know boys, you know that they need to run around outside and get completely knackered on a daily basis. So why would we put them in a school and make them sit still? You've got to be insane to come up with an educational solution like that. It's just never going to work, right? And when they come to my treatment room, I'm very aware that the fellas, they're having a harder time sitting there still. They need to be out and walking. That's why I love what you do. That's why I'll take what you do every day, Glenn.
The conversations we had on the hill, a lot of people say, why do you think that they had the conversations? And so openly about their conversations. And I think the biggest thing was when you're out in the mountains, you just walking, you're taking it in, you're not eye to eye, there's no nervousness in it, and it just gives you the ability to just talk, you know, you just let it out. You're not getting judged. And every now and again, it'd get quite intense and we'd stop and we'd get right into it and we'd have a great conversation. Then we'd carry on and just chat away again. And I'd always move through the group and talk to different people. And yeah, there's something to be said for active therapy. There's a huge benefit to it. And I know it's a bit of a thing that a lot of people are starting to look into, you know, walking therapy, which I think is awesome. I've done it myself, not officially, but yeah, caught up with people and said, let's catch up down the lake and we'll go for a walk. And I guess the other thing is, you know, people need to understand is if you are trying to help someone and they end up losing the battle, it's not your fault. You know, you've done all you can and no one needs to carry that burden. And everyone's scared that if they do something that they're going to be responsible for it. I mean, that one of those walks I talked about, that unfortunately that person ended up taking their life. This is a wee while back, right at the start of my journey. Do I feel the blame for that? Do I feel like I could have done more? No, that person was in a very bad place and I did what I could with the tools that I had and that's it. Very sad and I don't ever want to go down that road. But people need to understand it's not your fault. We're never going to stop this. When I'm not unrealistic to the fact that we're going to get to zero suicides. It's never, ever, ever going to happen. Never has and never will. But I'm sure as hell think we can get it from 600 plus down to 300 easy, especially in this country. We've got such a beautiful country to get out and enjoy. There's no reason for us to be sitting around those numbers. We've got a pretty good country to live in. So there's no reason to be sitting on such a high suicide rate, I believe. And you look at New Zealand, we're like a small country town when it on the scale of the world, when you look at, you know, America and Europe and, you know, we're just a small country. You know, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to all support each other very easily. Yeah.
Well, on that positive note, Glenn, we've run out of time. I can't believe it. I just looked at the clock and practically fell off my chair. We've run out of time, but Glenn, I love what you're doing. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing elements of your story and your life and also your struggles. I really appreciate that. And I'm sure the listeners would like me to say on their behalf as well, just, you know, thanks for stepping up, man. Thanks for talking out. Thanks for doing what you do. It's just so important that we all do this stuff and really want to say a big, big thank you for not just being here on the show, but for all the work you're doing. It's really, really important work. So bless you and thank you. And thanks for sitting in the psychotherapist chair with me.
No, I really appreciate you having me on. And I do want to say I'm very reachable. So if there is anyone out there that is struggling, no, I'm not a doctor and I don't have the answers, but I do have a listening ear and my phone is always on 24/7 and I would always listen to anyone if they needed it. So don't ever hesitate if there's someone out there to reach out to me. I can soon help guide you to the right place. If you're just in that, when you're in that moment, trying to find the answers is really hard. If someone can help guide you there, it just takes that pressure off. So yeah, feel free, anyone, reach out if you need it. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Glenn. And I'm going to ask you to come back in a bit for your music choices. That's going to be really exciting. But thanks for sitting in the chair, man.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.